Hello, this is Guillermo del Toro, and you're listening to Out Now Podcast. Hello.
We are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and guess what? This is Abe.
Hi, I am Abe.
Cha-ching.
Surprise.
You've made it. You've made it to one of our bonus episodes.
A single one.
Okay, well, Out Now is a film podcast, which has Abe and I normally discussing new movies. However, every now and then we like to have these special bonus episodes, whether it's one of our fun commentaries or something completely different. And this is another one of our completely different bonus horror episodes for the month of October. We've been doing these for a few weeks now. We started off with Wes Craven, then we focused on John Carpenter. This week we have an all-new focus on a different filmmaker who has a new film coming out this very week. His name is Guillermo del Toro. He has a new film, Crimson Peak, but he's also had a career focused around horror and fantasy and various other films of that nature. So we decided to shine the spotlight on him this week. I'm glad to have Abe on for this one. I know he's a scaredy pants. And joining Abe and I to discuss the filmmaker Guillermo del Toro, we have from Jobo.com, Jimmy O.
Yo. Yo, yo, yo. I think I'm more energetic tonight.
Okay.
I wasn't very energetic last week. I apologize.
It's all right.
For that.
I edited it so it sounded like you weren't there and we were all happier.
Oh, good. Yeah. I wouldn't know.
Total omission.
But
I was wondering why you guys had that joke where it didn't make sense.
Yeah, yeah. Jokes only work with me.
From StarPulse.com, Jason Coleman.
Oh, happy to be here. And again, my thank you, Aaron, for my request this week, of course, was to have the great Abe on, and he is here. So welcome, sir. Thanks for coming out. Appreciate it.
Jason, you know, anything for Aaron.
It's all good. That. It's all good.
I'm the pod father over here.
I really need that new boat, and you know, I gotta go and talk to the Godfather during the dance.
Lastly, from Naptown Nerd and YSoBlue.com, Brandon Peters.
Hello. Hopefully, I'm your favorite bonus whore.
Wow.
That's my favorite mimic quote. Well, yes, we are going to be talking about Guillermo del Toro this week. As you guys who may have been listening to these past horror episodes know, we're just kind of going over the filmmakers, their various films, what they've offered, what they've brought to the genre, and what have you. And so, yeah, we're really just going to jump right into it. And with that in mind, let's just get to some, you know, basic thoughts on Guillermo del Toro to begin with. And let's start with Jason. What are your thoughts on Guillermo del Toro?
Well, you know, it's kind of, for me, as a filmmaker, Guillermo is kind of up and down, you know? I mean, I think when he's telling stories that are personal and he's telling stories, frankly, that are in his wheelhouse, you know, his fantasy and touching on reality at the same time wheelhouse, I think his work is amazing. I also think he has some mainstream stuff that, even though it looks good, is kind of hollow. So, you know, there's some very big up and downs on this particular list for me. And but as a filmmaker, and especially as a visual filmmaker, there's no denying that Del Toro is very much has flair and has style and is a filmmaker to keep watching for. So.
Not to interject too much, but I, with the exception of Mimic, and again, not to get too ahead of ourselves, I really don't think there's a film on here that he hasn't had passion behind in terms of what he wanted to offer. Maybe Blade 2 to an extent. But
we'll see. We'll get into it.
Okay. Brandon, what are your thoughts on Guillermo del Toro?
I enjoy the guy a heck of a lot. I didn't really come on to being a hardcore fan of his till about Pan's Labyrinth, and then I went back and went through everything. He seems to, I mean, he's definitely visually amazing, and he seems to have a full understanding of every little ticking part in a lot of his movies, especially with his like worlds and creatures he creates. He seems to be that person that knows, I mean, you can see a background character in something of his, and you know, it tells its own story almost, which is quite a feat with that, even if he can't get it across with like human characters, which I think he does deal with well. My question is, why the heck don't people go see his movies?
That's a good question.
That's something we should get into as we analyze his films.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jimmy O, your thoughts on Mr. Del Toro?
Well, this is a hard one because I've had the absolute pleasure of interviewing him several times, and he's just really one of the nicest guys in the world, not just in Hollywood, but really, he's got the biggest heart. He's actually talked mariachi music with my kid, so I'm a fan of him as a person. As a filmmaker, I love what he does. It just, the thing about his films, you know, some of the complaints sometimes that they are, the characters aren't really strongly written or the scripts aren't really strongly written, but what he does do is he brings you into a world, and it's amazing. And it, every one of his films, even Mimic, I kind of like the non-theatrical version. Was it the director's cut, or which one was it?
He calls it a director's cut, I believe. Yeah,
yeah, that I kind of appreciate that film. I'm a fan of his, and there's ones I like a little more. Yeah, I'm just a big fan of his all around, and I always get excited, even if it's not my favorite of his works. Even when he produces a film with a new upcoming director, even if I don't like the film per se, and there's been a couple of those that I really didn't like.
We'll get to those.
Yeah, exactly. I love the guy. He's great, and I thank God we have him in film.
Abe, I know you haven't seen all of Del Toro's films.
I haven't.
I'm sure you have some opinions on them, man.
I started to
watch all of them right now.
I actually am. I have an implant in my brain, just like Giant Mnemonic. I'm watching it right now. But
I love, by the way, that you said Johnny Mnemonic and not The Matrix. That's awesome.
We just did a commentary for Johnny Mnemonic not too long ago.
The original Matrix. But no, he's a hardworking man. He's always producing something. He's got projects. He's doing everything from film to producing whatever else, doing video games that get canceled that are really creepy, apparently, that I'll never play. But I respect his work ethic because he's always there. And I quite honestly love him because he gave Aaron that little audio clip with Aaron and Abe. And he makes great tacos.
That probably started the show.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I respect him a lot. And again, I think that he's got a lot of great ideas. It's clear that he is a fan of, you know, comic books, horror, suspense, thriller, whatever else, things that are creepy in general. But he has a good time. Like, everything that I've heard from him or read from him and the interviews that he's done, he just seems like a genuinely fun guy to have a conversation with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's my favorite Mexican teddy bear. I've gotten the opportunity to meet Del Toro a number of times.
There are other Mexican teddy bears that you enjoy?
Yes. Okay. I don't need to get into that right now.
He likes a whole bunch. There's like a list.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've had the opportunity to speak with Del Toro a number of times, and he's just like Jimmy said, he is one of the nicest people. But in terms of like his filmmaking abilities and what he brings to, you know, the world of filmmaking in general as a producer, writer, helpful consultants on various things that we'll also get into, like he seems like such an indelible force. He has like all of this passion within him, and I love seeing him being able to release that onto the world. And I do wish that he'd, you know, get more mainstream love when it comes to these projects that are fairly ambitious that seem like, hey, this could really turn into something special, were more people to see it, or at least, you know, lead him on to other things that allow him to do something that, like, In the Mouth of Madness, for example, where, like, you could see something really amazing. Or, you know, if he had his versions of The Hobbits, like, I would have loved to see how that would have turned out. Probably, you know, a lot more streamlined, that's for damn sure. I mean, Guillermo del Toro is easily one of, like, the people who I get excited about instantly for a new project from him. And he's also one of the people who I'm very happy to always listen to when it comes to interviews, podcasts, commentary tracks, or whatever. He is a very insightful person with a wonderful Mexican accent that it's hard to resist hearing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's a great speaker.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. He is a great speaker. Like, it's great hearing him talk.
There's a lot of the Alfred Hitchcock Blu-rays have him speaking on them about stuff. You can just watch that stuff for like hours, and his commentaries too.
Let's talk about it. Okay, so Guillermo del Toro.
Let's go.
He has 9 films currently that he's directed, including the upcoming Crimson Peak, which Jimmy, you and I have seen Crimson Peak at this point.
We have absolutely.
And I'll be saving my full thoughts on it for the upcoming episode. But Jimmy, you can feel free to get into it when we get to that point.
Absolutely.
But it's certainly, you know, it's reflective of things that he's done in the past, to say the least.
Awesome.
Spoiler alert.
But with that in mind, I mean, Guillermo del Toro, do you want to just start with the films, I guess, and we kind of go from there?
Let's do it.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, first up, we have Kronos. I mean, there's, you know, some stuff he's toiled around with in the past, but Kronos is the first, you know, major theatrical feature. It took years to make, I believe, actually, given the amount of funding he had and what he had to work with. And it's one of the more intriguing vampire movies you'll probably ever see.
Right, definitely. It's very different.
Like, it's very much in the, like, it's very much in, like, the near dark realm in terms of, like, this is not the traditional vampire movie whatsoever.
Well, you know, going back and watching it, what really stands out to me, specifically about that movie, is the makeup effects. And, you know, having, Del Toro having worked with the great, you know, the legendary Dick Smith, you can see where some of those influences come from. And to me, that it really, you know, it really, the practical effects and the practical makeup and stuff really, really, you know, shines in that movie, and shows a real skill set that Del Toro kind of got from Dick Smith. So I love that part of it.
It's kind of a surprise vampire movie, really.
Right.
Because you don't really know what exactly is going on. It kind of builds into it. What sticks out to me about it is that it feels like a supernatural version of Blood Simple. Not that the plots are very similar, but in terms of kind of the low quality, not low quality, the low budget filmmaking at play there, the way Guillermo del Toro tries to attack, like, his themes and, like, what at the core of this film is very, very similar to me for what the Coen brothers are doing with that movie, where they have this, there's something about the minimalist nature of what they have to work with that still leads to, like, a certain intensity in both films. But Kronos is such, when seeing, you know, the kind of the mechanism that becomes this almost this obsession for this man, like, just in how he's drawn to it. And then you have, you know, obviously these other characters that are going after, with Ron Perlman stepping in for the first time in the Guillermo del Toro film. There's just all these things that make it just a really, really interesting film.
And that almost parasitic relationship between the guy and this odd, you know, mechanical yet monster inside kind of thing, you know, reminded me a little bit of Hennenlauter's Brain Damage, that parasitical relationship between feeding and being fed off of. So it's really an interesting and fascinating way of doing it, and then to work it into kind of a vampire thing as well, it definitely shows a lot of creativity.
Yeah, and his a lot of things that are present throughout, like, Del Toro filmography are right present right from the get-go. I mean, that mechanism that's feeding off, I mean, that thing's like a fully realized device. I mean, you buy into how it works. Like, I mean, it may be some fantastical device, but it looks and, like, just feels kind of logical within the film. Because he puts, like, so much thought to that, those little details.
Which, like you said, is very reflective of things that he'd go on to do in all of his other films. So even with the imagery there, I mean, that thing, it looks like it's like a bug, essentially. And there's a lot of kind of insect imagery in all of his movies, really.
Yeah, it's visual. I mean, there's so many cool visual, like the bathroom where he's licking up the blood from the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the rooftop scenes with the neon signs and Ron Perlman chasing, those are just, like, really cool, memorable stuff from this early, really independent movie.
It's neat. I always love the use of color in with foreign filmmakers, especially, you know, Italian filmmakers, obviously, and honestly, Spanish filmmakers. I mean, while Del Toro makes, you know, supernatural and fantasy type movies, you can see why he and, like, Almodovar are good friends. Like, yeah. you can certainly get a feel for, like, what these two share with each other.
Absolutely, absolutely. Good group of guys there.
Oh yeah, Coron as well. The three amigos, as they refer to themselves. It's Iñárritu, right? Isn't it Iñárritu?
he's there too.
Which one do you think?
I think it's those three. Almodovar. What? Sorry.
Which one do you think Martin Short would play?
Martin.
I'm thinking he'd play Guillermo del Toro.
He'd play Del Toro.
Yeah, he's a little shorter.
Yeah, Chevy Chase would be Coron.
You know, I've never seen three amigos.
What?
Never seen Three Amigos.
You never seen Three Amigos?
Wow.
Never seen Three Amigos.
It's just, it's just a Seven Samurai, but an hour shorter and four people less.
I know. Very similar.
It's a great analogy.
That should be when the Three Amigos Criterion Edition comes out. I hope my essay about it is that's the quote that's on there.
It will be. For for sure.
Criterion, for sure. I'm not getting ahead of myself whatsoever on that one.
No, not at all.
But it was interesting how you were talking about people that they started with. Obviously Ron Perlman, you know, in this, and then Federico Lupi, who went on to do the other two, Pan's Labyrinth and Devil's Backbone. Yeah, so great work by both of them. So can see where that, if anything, it definitely started a great relationship between all of those guys. So,
and you easily see, you know, where his. Like he'd go on to, you know, continue building off what he grew up with, what he's a big fan of in his other films as well. But you can see how he has a huge passion for, you know, the older horror films, which comes, you know, him kind of taking his love for that, you know, that genre, that style of filmmaking, and putting it into his own work. Like, it's already early clear right here.
Along with those films, again, the films that I talked about where they're in his wheelhouse or you know, ones that feel more Del Toro to me, that's definitely, Cronos is definitely one of them, because of the slowness and the willingness to take time and to really explore all the characters and the themes and everything. And there's again, just like when we talked about Carpenter early on, how he took time. Cronos is definitely one of those films that relishes in taking time with details that I love.
It's his first film. It'd be hard to think that it's not, you know, a big passion project. And, like, again, I didn't get into this too much, but Cronos took a long time to film, guys.
Yeah,
this
movie, it really did. Yes, it did.
He began trying to get this thing together in the 80s. Like, there was a lot of things that went into this movie, which you can learn more about on the very awesome Criterion Collection Blu-ray of Cronos, which came out, like, I think, like, 2010 or, like, back a few years. But let's move on. For some reason, things stop, and he doesn't make another movie until Mimic, until 1997's Mimic, his first foray into studio filmmaking with the Weinsteins at his back. This is not a good time for Del Toro. In addition to dealing with making this movie and having Harvey Weinstein trying to fire him from making this movie, his father was also kidnapped during this time, I believe, as well. I think this is when that was happening.
I mean, if you weren't Quentin Tarantino or Robert Rodriguez and you were making a movie with the Weinsteins in the 90s, you probably weren't having a good time.
Yeah.
Which is odd, because you would think, because, you know, that was what was always surprising to me, because the Weinsteins always felt to me like guys who would back up their filmmakers. And it really is. I mean, if you look at the cavalcade of filmmakers that have come out of, you know, Miramax at that point, there was a lot of great ones. But it really felt like, with Del Toro, they messed up. That was the one they actually should admit and say, we made a mistake. What we did was wrong with Del Toro. Because they really did rake him right over the coals.
They essentially did if he was allowed to make his director's cut. I mean, he didn't.
Well, no. But Lionsgate was the one who
was releasing that
blue, and getting into that Blu-ray. The Blu-ray, I agree with Jimmy, is friggin' fabulous. It really put the film back in perspective in terms of style and pace, but it's totally 100% candid, as he says, as legally as much as possible. He is candid about everything, and those guys raked him over the coals. And listen, I'm a huge Weinstein fan. I think that they've done some amazing work, but that was a mistake on their part.
I think it certainly comes with more with foreign filmmakers for sure as well. When it comes to the Weinsteins and what they seem to want to do with the movies that they get a level of control over, and young filmmakers for sure.
Well, look at the very first thing. The first thing was from the special edition where we was talking about the different ideas. He said that originally he wanted scarabs for the monsters, mm-hmm. but it was the great who was it? It was Bob Weinstein. He wanted roaches, so that's why you have Mimic with roaches in it. So it's, you know, there's always,
to be fair, these roaches look more like the humans that they're trying to replicate, right, than get scarabs.
that's true.
Yeah.
But that special edition, you know, some interesting things in terms of pacing. Mira Sorvino, I think, you know, much better, her performance in what they showed in that special edition, because I think she might have been a little bit more forgettable in the original movie. But in that special edition, they do beef up the role a little bit, and you really do see
some urgency in her character.
There's
few people here that I would really say are, like, given, like, amazing performances. Like, honestly, right. I mean, I like Mimic well enough director's cut certainly helps, but it is easily my least favorite Del Toro movie.
Absolutely. Mine too.
It has a great cast, though. Amir Sorvino, Jeremy Northam, Josh Brolin, Charles S. Rock, F. Murray Abraham, and pre-Daryl Norman Reedus, who became a Del Toro favorite for at least two movies. So, and Doug Jones, I believe, in his first Del Toro role as well. So.
Yep. That's one of the things I like about Del Toro is, like, you know, people that work with him just love him and they want to work with him on everything. And I think that.
Watching Crimson Peak, it has a mix of people from his movies and from The Strain and people he's worked before as behind the scenes. Like, it's a Del Toro mainstay in that movie for sure.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
But anyway, some other interesting points from that. There was rewrites on the script by both John Stales and Steven Soderbergh, of course, who had worked with the Weinsteins on Sex Lies. Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah.
Right. So there's an interesting conversation between the two of them on the director's chair, where he specifically talks about coming in and being forced to reshoot some of Guillermo's footage, which he thought was odd because he said we don't have the same look. And and the Jeremy Northam role was actually originally Del Toro wanted Andre Brower and then John Turturro, but the powers that be felt that an interracial relationship that the America wasn't ready for that. So that's why why Jeremy Northam was in there. It's really, and this is just scratching the surface, but really candid stuff both in the interview and in the commentary on that movie that makes it a fascinating thing to get. I would definitely recommend that.
Jeremy Northam is now a megastar that we can't stop seeing in
that movie. That guy makes so many Denny's commercials, I can't get enough.
I love Denny's so much
because of Jeremy Northam.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I mean, Jeremy Northam from here would go on to such blockbusters as Happy Texas and The Winslow. So I mean,
he was in Emma, and that movie rocks.
He was coming off of Emma, so I mean, clearly everyone was on the Northam train at that point.
Never.
Meanwhile, like Andre Brower is like, what? The guy from Homicide, this incredibly successful TV show? Screw that. Yeah. John Turturro, guy's never going to work another day in his life. Clockers? More like snorers. That's what they said.
Is that your quote for the DVD box?
That's great. Yeah. That quote I want to see on the DVD box.
I've offended all the Spike Lee Clocker fans out there, so I apologize. And I do think Jeremy Dorn, even though the ending of Mimic is fucking ridiculous, Mimic's ending is fucking ridiculous.
Well, tell me what it is.
Like, so, the
spoiler alert.
At this point, there's giant moth creatures everywhere. Charles Rock just sacrificed himself. Mira Sorvino and the little boy are trying to get the hell out of there. And what does Northrum do? He gets everything ready. They're gonna blow up a nest. He's released all this gas all over the place, and he gets an axe, and he's next to like this manhole cover or something, and he starts trying to strike it. He strikes this thing with the axe because there's all these gas fumes, so he can blow up the entire nest. He keeps hitting it, and these giant moths are getting closer to him, and he finally sparks it, and then there's this giant explosion. Outside, you see outside in New York, manhole covers are flying up all over the place. They're blowing up everywhere because of how big this explosion is. But while you would think that this would incinerate Jeremy Northam, who is at ground zero of where this explosion took place, but he was able to somehow ignite this thing from the manhole cover and then jump into the water that was below him just in the nick of time. Because he saunters on out of the subway just as Mira Sorvino could see him, be like, oh, good, you made it. I thought that giant explosion that wrecked all of downtown New York would have gotten you.
He's Jeremy Northam.
And we're spending so much time on Mimic, by the way. This is why Mimic still is his weakest movie to me, because I was really curious if the director's cut would be like, oh, clearly that was an alternate ending because we wanted a happy ending. Nope, not the case. That's always been the ending of Mimic, where he strikes up this explosion and then survives. Anyway, it's like that scene in Pitch Black, and that the trailer shot where like he blows onto the alcohol and it, like all these creatures are around him. It's like, that's really cool. And then he dies. It's the exact opposite of that. That's what that is.
Wow.
Anyway, following Mimic, Guillermo del Toro not happy with how the Weinsteins treated him, let alone the fact that his father was kidnapped and he had to deal with that and all New Mexico and all that, decides to get a little more personal. makes a very personal movie called The Devil's Backbone. His first foray into period drama and the Spanish Civil War, which he'd revisit again in Pan's Labyrinth. His 2001 film is fantastic, produced by Pedro Almodovar, by the way. Mm-hmm. It is a wonderful ghost story in the vein of other kind of draw, like something like that he'd go on to produce, like The Orphanage. It's very much a drama, a period drama that happens to have supernatural elements and not the other way around, I would say. Do you guys agree?
Exactly.
Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
And something I really, and I'll let you guys talk because I haven't talked for a while with all that mimic nonsense, but something I really enjoy about this that's just decidedly Del Toro is his world building and specifically his very distinct imagery that he uses to kind of set up a thing that you will be set to remember. When I think of The Devil's Backbone, what I think of is that bomb that's lodged in the middle of this like orphanage out in the middle of the desert that is malfunctioned, and it just sits there cracked into the surface, and people are like, what is this? Like, do we touch this? What can we do with this? No idea. It's just the way Del Toro's, you know, films this in the same way that he films that machine that we talked about in Kronos, or even kind of depicts the looks of the moths, or depicts Pan and just the way that imagery sticks out to me in this movie. That's such a great thing that I love about this movie, which I consider to be my second favorite Del Toro movie.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, that could be that piece. I mean, I never thought of it until you just started talking about it, but you know, that piece could, I mean, and that could be me, you know, making a mountain out of a molehill, but it could be, you know, the idea of here is this idyllic kind of setting where children are being, you know, are being taken in from the outside, and you know, in the middle, in the center of all of this, is this piece of impending doom where you never know what's going to happen.
Exactly.
Is it going to explode? Is it going to whatever? And that may, you know, again, that could be maybe some of the fallout of Mimic for Del Toro. Maybe he, you know, that's what he felt or whatever. But whatever it was, I agree with you. Devil's Backbone is a fantastic piece of work. And going back and looking at it, by the way, one of the things that really struck me was the sound design. There's a really specific and interesting sound design on that movie that not only helps with story, but also helps with the scares a lot, which I really liked in that movie.
For sure.
Yeah, it's also the first film he put with the Spanish Civil War as a background to it, which is pretty impactful. Time stuff, which he'd once again later on with Pan's Labyrinth revisit.
It's something I love that he, like, of the time periods he chooses, he very specifically chooses the Spanish Civil War. Like, it makes, you know, sense, obviously, given, you know, his own background and whatnot, but it's not even a film that tries to teach you a history lesson. It just uses that as a backdrop. Like, you could easily tell the story of The Devil's Backbone. It's a story that could be told at any other time, but I love how the way it gives to a very specific time and place and allows you to kind of dive into this world.
And there's a personal feel in all of those movies. Remember, I was talking about when he gets personal, when it's in his wheels. There's a personal feel to for when I see Del Toro using that. It feels like Scorsese going into Goodfellas, or it feels like, you know what I mean, like somebody who feels the authenticity and wants to show it to you in a passionate way. Where you were talking about, Aaron.
Well, so also, it adds a sense of sort of like defeat to everything too, because I mean that Spanish Civil War. I mean. The fascists won that.
Yeah.
So there's that sense of, you know, a little sense of darkness surrounding it with, you know, unhappy ending to everything. So you kind of have that extra lump of, you know, disdain on, like, your characters in the film and stuff, just knowing, you know, that consequences aren't ending in a happy one.
Completely agree. I mean, it's Devil's Backbone is an R-rated film for whatever that's worth. But, like, something you kind of see in a lot of his movies is that they're very accessible. Like, I mean, the kind of the scares are there if you want to find it, or the mood and the tension, like, obviously makes it more skewed towards adults. But I mean, there are these films that he makes, this and Pan's Labyrinth specifically, they are about children, and they are about kind of an innocence growing into a loss of innocence. And it's very neat to see him kind of allow that to be in his world, allow that to be something that makes it able for kind of all audiences to kind of tune into this thing. There's essentially a fable being told, which is something that you know, generally educate your children with. And that's
Grimm's Grimm's fairy tale, but with a bit of a realistic slant to it. It's great.
And it comes from where Del Toro, you know, he grew up, you know, obviously loving the fantasy genre and the world and the supernatural, and how he applies that to make movies that are personal to him makes a level of sense that he can, I'd assume, kind of, you know, show his children at a proper age when he, you know, wants to, because he's made these movies that work as kind of very, very heavy on fairy tale imagery and whatnot, along with, you know, the other themes going on. This one also has another amazing Criterion edition, by the way.
Yes.
With improved subtitles. That was a huge problem that he had with the movie. The subtitles are terrible on the original version.
Right. Yeah, and I actually need to pick that up. That's one of the Criterion I need, definitely.
All right. Well, then, after Devil's Backbone, which is met with a lot of acclaim, he jumps back into the studio system with Blade 2, which I would say is the best of the Blade films. And I really like the first Blade, but I think Blade 2 is fantastic. And it's largely because of what Del Toro brings to the world and in the creature design. I really love the enemy vampires that Blade is facing off against in this film. The Reapers.
Now, that's interesting, because I think you and I definitely differ. Not on the creatures. I agree. The creatures are great, and all the visual style stuff is amazing.
You're a huge Blade Trinity fan?
No, I'm a good Blade fan. Now, see, in the original Blade, what I liked about the original Blade was that Wesley Snipes really, and now I think this is more to do with the script than it is to Del Toro, but in the original Blade, he didn't talk all that much, and I think that's what was effective to me, is you lost the Snipes, you got the Blade. In Blade 2, he was wisecracking a lot. That was Snipes. That didn't feel as Blade to me. And also, the script is very obvious, you know, like when you had Norman Reedus in there, and he was talking to Kris Kristofferson, saying, oh, you're like a father figure to him, and I'm thinking, no, we are already know that. You're stating the obvious. There's a lot of things in that script that were very, like, that we know that were obvious. It felt more like David Goyer was being a little lazy on that script.
Which is something that Guillermo del Toro is very happy to reflect in his commentary track. He makes fun of David S. Goyer, and it's fantastic. He's very much aware of the limitations of that screenplay. What you're saying about, you know, Blade being more chatty, essentially, or, you know, wisecracking.
Yes.
There is an ensemble cast here. I mean, he has the Blood Pack led by, you know, Ron Perlman and the gang.
So even more so why he would let, you know, Ron Perlman and the gang do their quips as opposed to Blade. Because Blade was the stoic person in that first movie. And that's what kind of made it, again, that's what made that character so memorable. In this one, you had it. I love the ensemble.
Did you say that's what made that character so memorable? What I remember about Blade.
From all the Snipes movies? Absolutely.
When I think of Snipes in Blade 1, I think motherfucker's always trying to ice skate uphill. I think of him quipping. Like, that's what I think of. I don't think of him being
Snipes. There was very few. There was a lot more in Blade 2. I got definitely that it was more Snipes than Blade. I'm not saying there wasn't any quips in the first movie. I'm just saying it definitely stood out to me in that second movie. It was way more Snipes.
There's a slight tone change going from 1 to 2.
Yes,
that definitely feels that way. I'm not the biggest Blade 2 fan either. I do like the creature design stuff. There's just something that's never really just sat with me very well with Blade 2. I don't know. I find the Blade Mobile to be quite kind of hilarious.
Blade Mobile.
Yeah.
I think there's just such a great, like, I think the world building is so, like, I think Stephen Norrington does a great job in the first Blade. I think I really like the first Blade a lot. I mean, that rave sequence alone, the opening of that film is one of the better superhero openings of any superhero movie. If I had to, like, really put that list together. But, like, something, I mean, I really like how, like, as much as I like Stephen Dorff in the first Blade, I think Luke Goss, who would come back in Hellboy 2, which is a better movie, I think he does a great job of creating a sympathetic villain, for one. Like, that aspect of it's really effective for me. And that Reaper design is so, like, he ripped that off for The Strain now. Like, it's like, that's how much you love that design. It's such a neat thing. Yeah.
I feel like Blade 2 is kind of claustrophobic, too. It never really goes outside, I feel. It's, like, all in sewers, all in interior places.
Jimbo,
I feel like it doesn't, like, breathe.
What do you think of Blade 2, man? I'm not hearing anything from you.
You guys are – it's a lot of people. You guys are saying what I need to say. I love Blade 2. I prefer it over – clearly Blade Trinity is the best. But no, I prefer Blade 2. I absolutely prefer Blade 2. I agree with everything Aaron is saying. I just think it's, I don't know, I had more fun. I thought it had a little bit I know, I like the humor, I liked everything, and I love the creature design. I loved everything about Blade 2. It's still not my favorite Del Toro film, but definitely my favorite Blade film.
Yes, Sticky Fingers will always be my Blade.
that's absolutely correct.
Flight of the Phoenix and Sticky Fingers?
Sticky Fingers, yeah.
Blade 2, you know, it does its job. Like, it's a success enough, and it gets a lot of... it gets a lot of praise. Ebert's a huge Guillermo del Toro fan, by the way. If we haven't pointed this out, I try to go to Ebert every time, but like it's just neat seeing the things that he responds to as we talk about horror films, given the level of the kind of the use of effects and whatnot. Since you know, last week we talked about John Carpenter, and Brandon, you talked about how Ebert just hated the '80s, essentially.
Yeah.
When you look at someone like del Toro, who does jump into kind of. Not crazy gory, but I mean, you look at Kronos or Mimic or Blade 2, which has, autopsies of vampires and goes all into it. And all of those films, including Mimic, got 3.5 stars from Ebert. Like, he's like all in on this. Like, I don't know what that is, essentially, but among other, critics that, enjoy what Guillermo del Toro brings to the table. Blade 2, not received as well as, like, something like Devil's Backbone, obviously. It's just not. Moving to the next thing is his next superhero film, actually. It's Hellboy.
Yes,
which is Guillermo del Toro's favorite superhero, and he basically seems like a dream movie for him as he gets to make a movie with Ron Perlman, his preferred lead choice, as the lead character in a Hellboy
which
movie.
Is great, by the way.
In Hellboy, yes, yeah. It's not a pretty hero; it's a devil essentially, a large red costume with horns, a big red hand. There's going to be a lot of makeup, a lot of prosthesis to make this, and amidst a world that's also filled with other creatures and crazy designs. And so he does this. It makes money. It makes enough, apparently, to get Universal being like, hey, we should get a sequel going, and we could probably talk about that when we get to Hellboy 2. Mm. But, I remember Sony putting this out, and honestly, I wasn't too familiar with Hellboy. Like, I've heard about it in the past, but it wasn't like, man, there's a trailer for Hellboy out? What is this about? Like, I was more... Okay, we got a Hellboy movie coming. Oh, and Brandon, you said you didn't get into Del Toro really until like Pan's Labyrinth, when you kind of really started to know who he was. Is there...
Right. Well, because all I knew was Mimic and Blade 2 at the time was what I was familiar with him.
See, like I had seen Mimic, and like obviously I'm not like, man, Del Toro, that's a guy that's going places after Mimic. But like I remember I saw Devil's Backbone when it was like on HBO at one point, and I remember I was younger. And I was like, this is interesting, but I wasn't like paying too much attention. Then I saw Blade 2, I was like, huh, that's the same guy that did the Moth movie and the Ghost Kids movie. All right, let's see. And then Hellboy happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, from Hellboy was where I really started to be like, I was anticipating this because I saw that name again. And that's where I started to get into it. But I'll get to my thoughts on the movie later. What do you guys think of Hellboy?
There's an interesting dynamic difference between Hellboy and Hellboy 2, which both are valid films, but Hellboy to me feels a little more popcorny to me in terms of Del Toro's work. And not that I didn't like that. I love that. And what's interesting is he almost seems a little more wisecracky. It's like kind of the opposite Blade thing, where I think Hellboy seems a little more wisecracky in the first movie and maybe a little less in the second movie. But the original Hellboy is such popcorn fun. And, because when we start going into Pacific Rim, I know you're a big fan of it, but Hellboy to me is like the best of both worlds. You have the popcorn fun, but there's some great imagery and awesome stuff. And I had a blast with Hellboy. And frankly, besides Beauty and the Beast, name one role that Ron Perlman is pitch perfect at. That is his role, hands down.
Sons of Anarchy,
City of Lost
Children. Good, but this is his role.
City of Lost Children. I mean, that's
dude learned
another language to play that movie.
I've told this before, but I used to think he was French because that was the first exposure I had to Ron Perlman. And when I saw him in other movies, I was like, he's got a really good American accent.
Hellboy's. I mean, it's really good. I mean. I can't imagine the thing with the Hellboy movies is I can't imagine anyone other than Del Toro doing them. Like, I don't want to. Like, he has a perfect handle on the characters and how to tell the stories in these movies. And the first one's really good, a really good movie. It's fun. He had to shoehorn in that in character. Like, yeah, that wasn't in Del Toro's plan at all. And when he got a little more full reign, he was gone. But I was really surprised. The first movie, I missed it in the theater. It wasn't until after Pan's Labyrinth that I went back and watched Hellboy, and I really enjoyed it.
Uh-huh.
Abe, you've seen Hellboy. Please tell me you've seen Hellboy.
I've seen the first half of Hellboy. You know, the cool rain sequence, and they find, Hellboy as a little baby boy, and cool stuff happens, and then I was like, I have to go do something.
Fine.
Hellboy.
Because I was bored. I just really had to go do something. I can't remember what it was, though. That was like 8 years ago.
Hellboy.
It's on Netflix. Put it on right now.
Hellboy, to me, I like Hellboy. I don't love Hellboy. And it increases dramatically my love for Hellboy when we get to the sequel of it. But
yeah, it's kind of hard to talk about both, one at a time, because I think a lot of people prefer the sequel to Hellboy. I know,
but but it's interesting though, because they're completely different. So it's interesting to sort of look back at. It's easy to go.
Well, let's
Hellboy
talk about
too.
It. Let's talk about Hellboy 2 also, because we can skip.
All right,
get to Hellboy.
Sure. Okay. So I mean, coming off of Pan's Labyrinth, that movie is makes a whole lot of sense, because what he's doing is he's going, well, I'm going to add my stamp, my mystical fable like stamp onto the Hellboy label. So it's completely different. The first movie is very popcorny. The second movie has a lot of thought, a lot of creatures, a lot of intricate things going on. So they're two completely different movies. But I gotta tell you, I love the original Hellboy, because it's easy to just go, well, it's not as deep or as meaningful as the second Hellboy. But a popcorn movie that's good, I'm all for it. And I think that's why I like the original Hellboy. The Hellboy 2 is great, but I think it's definitely a lot more for the Pan's Labyrinth crowd.
I can see
say that like it's a bad thing.
I can see what.
No, it's just but a lot of people go, oh no, that's his work. Hellboy is just kind of like wasn't his thing. Maybe somebody else wanted him to do it. But see, I like the original Hellboy.
You say the first Hellboy is like a perfect balance of popcorn fun and
for me, yeah.
But that's what I think Hellboy 2 is, though, because I think it's a movie that's incredibly deep of what it's trying to do, but also has it's super fun to watch. I mean, like
Hellboy 2 is a little less popcorny for me.
I can't,
it's a little more on the thoughtful level, especially after coming off of Pan's Lab. You can see some a lot more thought going into that movie.
But I can see the balance being stronger for me, where I feel like Hellboy, yes, it feels more inconsequential. Like if anything, Hellboy drags for me. That's my main issue with it. And that's why I was always like, the director's cut's like, fine, I guess, but I don't need more of this movie. Like, I feel like it needs to like be streamlined a bit, like with that. Just the constant drama of Selma Blair, whether or not she's going to come to the house or what, like, it just seems like so belabored. Where Hellboy 2, I love it for just being, and something I like about Hellboy is that he's already Hellboy at that point, which entertains me. But Hellboy 2 just feels like he blew up in the universe. It makes it so much more interesting. And again, we get an incredibly compelling villain played by Luke Goss. That entire storyline is so wonderfully handled.
Why is Luke Goss not making bigger pictures? Because the guy is actually seriously talented.
You got like Brandon. What's the other actor that's in a lot of like direct-to-video like action movies?
Scott Atkins.
Scott Atkins. You're thinking of Scott Atkins. I just don't see it with him. But Luke Goss, I like him a lot.
Yeah, I do too.
I get him.
Generally like him.
But see, I think I'd still give credit to Carl Rodman, Mr. Rasputin. I like him in that first Hellboy, man. He was kind of creepy. So again, he doesn't have the mythical quality again of Luke. But I like
Hellboy's goes for like the like Nazis are evil, so Nazis.
Yeah,
like they're default de facto.
Pretty simple.
Nazis.
Right. So with Hellboy 2, it's okay. I'll put it out here. Like Hellboy 2 is one of my favorite comic book movies. One of my favorite sequels.
Yes.
Like one of my favorite comic book sequels. I love Hellboy 2. The worst thing to happen to Hellboy 2 was The Dark Knight came out the next week.
Yeah.
Hellboy 2 got a lot of praise. It made some solid money, and then that happened, and it was quickly forgotten. But I mean, that movie, it's terrific. It continues to explore Hellboy's world, adds some more layer to the characters, that future prophecy, everything else, and it just all the
it perfectly sets up Hellboy 3.
Right, yeah. All the little mechanics of
film
like,
we were still waiting for and we probably never will get, which
yeah, like there's
sad.
That scene, there's it has its own kind of like cantina scene where they go to like that marketplace where like all there's all these creatures that are all like wonderfully realized, whether they're in the background, have one line, have a fight with Hellboy. You
which
get
is,
like which Ghostbusters on, kind of action.
On the Blu-ray for Hellboy 2, that marketplace scene, there's like a 30-minute feature just describing everything going on in that world that we get right. Like, you know, 10 minutes of, that Del Toro very clearly says, I could easily do the CGI, but I'm not going to. I'm going to make every character count, and that's what he does. It's
ridiculous. Exactly. And Doug Jones got to, like, speak and act, you know, fully Abe Sapien.
Yeah, they had David Hyde Pierce.
There's also the drinking scene with the Can't Smile Without You, which is phenomenal.
There's a lot of great soundtrack cues, like when Hellboy, like when he falls out the window. Oh my god.
And the giant plant monster he fights,
in the limited time the plant monster has, I feel bad for the plant monster. Like, what? This is how effective this movie is.
Blind witch, which is like, oh my gosh, scary, creepy. It's awesome. Like, it's Del Toro, you know, his back-to-back of Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy is just outstanding when it comes to, like, creatures and environments and stuff. I think the peak so far if you look at his short little resume, but man, that back-to-back is just, he's on it right there. And I can't. And even like Selma Blair is somebody who I was kind of like ho-hum on, but because of Hellboy movies, I'm a big fan of Selma Blair.
Again, I like her a lot more in 2 because she's so like proactive.
Yeah.
Movie, like,
mm-hmm. I agree.
Everybody feels more comfortable with,
for sure,
in 2. Yeah,
and Jeffrey Tambor doing anything like these movies, he's fantastic. This cast is great.
2's like, well, we didn't think we'd be here anyway, so hey, let's just kick it and have some fun. But yeah, and I think 2 was some, because the first Stoney did the first one, and then like Universal got the rights to like sequel titles or something like that, and they just decided, it's, you know, better than just sitting on something. And went with Hellboy 2.
Well, like Hellboy had, like, it was a strong, DVD like sale, which Wade Squire got its like 3-disc director's cut edition, everything. Like they're really big on the DVD. So it was Sony, but they're really big on the DVDs for Hellboy. Like I remember that was.
Mm-hmm.
Was Hellboy 2 was lower budget than Hellboy 2, wasn't it?
No. It had a bump, but not too much. But
okay.
I could see the scale being bigger in Hellboy 2. You look at the Golden Army. And the places they go, the giant creatures they meet. That's my favorite Dr. Seuss book. The places they go, the giant creatures they'll meet. But there's just a lot there that I really love.
It's just,
you know what,
I mean,
you know what I like about the Hellboy movies, at least for me, is like they grow on you. The more you watch them, the more you get. And I think this is very true for a lot of Del Toro's films, is that you... I don't know. In fact, when I first saw the Hellboy 2, I was like, there was something that felt like it was missing to me, but... The more I see it, the more I love it. Same with Pacific Rim. I mean, that really, the films really grow on you.
I think with Hellboy 2, something that makes me admire it more also is that it just, like, for the Hellboy, it just feels, the first one feels repetitive in terms of the enemies he's fighting. It's just like crazy dog creatures that have big tongues. This one, there's just so many other things going on in it. Again, I like Hellboy. It's just like Hellboy 2 just felt like such a drastic increase in everything that I liked about it, doing it better.
It definitely was inspired by the fable work of Pan's Labyrinth. There's no doubt about that.
For sure. Like, having a kind of, I don't know what you ought to call it, being, like, recharged by doing something like Pan's Labyrinth that gave him, you know, enormous credit, like, all over the place. It certainly worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy, you describe it as, you know, it grows on you. I mean, that's Hellboy right there. He has two things, you know. He'll always look this good. And he'll never give up on you.
Absolutely.
Let's jump back a bit now. Let's get to the other movie we, you know, kind of mentioned, Pan's Labyrinth, which...
Masterpiece.
...is one of my favorite films ever.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
Is it good?
It's pretty good.
It's pretty brilliant.
You have to read, though, so...
Yeah.
Pan's Labyrinth is so haunting and such a beautiful film on every level. And it's such a... I love how the horror of it is not even... The horror is just everything going on in the real world. It's terrifying.
The horror is Sergio Lopez's character.
Yeah,
I mean, Pale Man is an amazing creation. I love the design of it. But the captain that he played, or is he a captain? I believe he's a captain. That character is such a...
One of my favorite film villains,
yes,
like, ever.
Such a great villain.
Oh,
yes.
My gosh.
Like, as opposed to something like Christoph Waltz in Inglourious Basterds, he's like likable even though he's evil. You look at this man... he is evil. Like you can respect maybe the logic he has for how he does things, but he is an evil person.
He even gets to become kind of a monster of his own once he gets his like mouth sliced open and he sews it.
Amazingly filmed scene, by the way.
Just, yes.
Like, and this we haven't talked about kind of many of the people working like with Guillermo throughout all this, but Guillermo Navarro is cinematographer. He has a number of people doing his scores, but Javier Navarrete, like the score for Pan's Labyrinth is wonderful. The effects work that he gets to, you know, to work on these movies and make incredible practical designs are always top notch. Like, it's such a great combination of talents that Guillermo del Toro is clearly like picking up and just knows what people to work with to fully realize these visions that he has that he sketches out in his notebooks all over the place.
Name me the film that won Best Foreign Picture Oscar over Pan's Labyrinth.
The Lives of Others.
Ouch.
Wow.
Which
wow.
is a very good film, although I was mad at it for quite a long time.
Exactly. Exactly. I couldn't have told you. I'd forgotten, but...
Yeah, it's interesting you're talking about...
I'm mad at it enough where I remember the movie. That's why I remember it. But...
It's interesting you talk about DP Navarro on this, because you definitely his stamp on this, you seeing the visual change between, you know, between worlds of what you would consider to be reality and fantasy and vice versa is also, you know, a really big key player in terms of, you know, creating those worlds. I mean, obviously you've got great monsters and you've got great characters, but I think this above most of the work that those two have done together, I think this is Navarro's masterpiece.
Navarro did win an Academy Award for Best Cinematography this year, so that certainly helps with that one. Again, much like The Devil's Backbone, that's, you know, we focus on a child. I mean, this is a movie that's essentially a dark fairy tale, and it's such a wonderful mix of having, you know, a fantasy world that's, you know, completely original that we get to visit now and again with the kind of the stark reality that she is a part of. And learning, you know, using her as a guide character, essentially, even though I like her character, Ophelia, quite a bit, it's neat to see, you know, her meet these other people, such as the housekeeper, Mercedes.
Yes. Mercedes,
It's like learning her character and how she's tied into, I guess, I don't know, I'm not trying to spoil things, but tied into the events that are going on around her, because this is once again set during the Spanish Civil War. It's just fascinating to me. I loved learning both about the fantastical world going on as well as this other world that we're seeing. And you mentioned Navarro and his masterwork. I love the stark contrast of the looks of both worlds, where it's a lot of like cold colors and steel blues and whatnot going on, and the use of rain. And again, you mentioned sound design earlier too. I love something that always stuck out to me. This is going to sound funny. The sound of umbrellas opening in Pan's Labyrinth is something I truly love. There's something about that gets to me that I really love. I'm done for now. You keep talking about
Pan's Well, you know what also works in Pan's Labyrinth that is not present in a lot of the other Del Toro films is he kind of channels his inner like Neil Marshall, and the violence in the movie hurts. Like it's like out.
Oh,
like
yeah.
That guy gets like beaten in the face in the beginning before they're shot, and then he really makes his violence just, I mean, you cringe when you see it, and it's hard to pull off. And this is the only movie he's really gone for it. And,
there is actually a scene.
You'll see how Crimson Peak plays out.
There's one scene in Crimson Peak that's pretty. Wow.
But no, I know exactly, especially in a movie like this, where, and that's like that scene where you're talking about where a man gets like his face beaten in. That's an intro to, you know, what's to come, essentially, to a point. But it's also that, like, you get to this movie, you understand, like, there's this little girl, and she doesn't like being where she is, and you get a sense that this man is very stern. But that scene really just takes you to a different level of, like, what kind of man this is.
It's what keeps these little moments like that keep you from showing this fairy tale movie to your children, even if it is, it's like, oh, that's just a bit too much.
And you have to give a hats off to Doug Jones on this movie.
Oh my
because
God,
again, having done, I mean, he obviously had done some amazing stuff with Abe Sapien and the stuff he did in Mimic, but really those two characters and the fluidity of playing those, you know, bringing those to life with, you know, just sheer body language is unbelievable. He is such an unsung hero of this movie.
who doesn't speak Spanish and had to learn it and purposely learned his lines to get this down. Oh my god!
And the captain, you know, he has a great like death. Like it's so satisfactory. Like it's awesome. It's a unique kill. And then what they tell him, like, oh yeah, your son's never gonna know who you are. Mm-hmm. Like that's just awesome.
He's a good actor, by the way, Sergio Lopez. I've seen him in a number of things.
Yeah, he's very good.
I like when he pops up in random things. Like, oh, cool. I didn't see that coming. That's great. God, I could expound all that. We just do a Pan's Labyrinth commentary right now. Pan's Labyrinth. I was very happy to see how well recognized it was. I remember something that warmed my heart was the Oscars that year. When Pan's Labyrinth was being represented, the intro to the Oscars, it had like every single nominee was doing like something to like represent what they're doing, and the composer, he started whistling the theme for Guillermo del Toro for Pan's Labyrinth, and for whatever reason, the audience just started cheering, like whatever, like this was like live or whatever, so they're like playing this intro clip in front of this entire audience at the Academy Awards, and everyone just started cheering when they started hearing the theme to that movie, and I was like, this is so great, that Guillermo del Toro
everything
has a movie
works
like
about
this.
The movie,
yeah.
Everything, like even it's got a memorable, like you hear that score, and you're just like, oh yeah, it's from Pan's Labyrinth.
Okay. There's a number of things that Guillermo del Toro is producing between this and his next film, and I want to get to the stuff that he's kind of been involved with on the side later, so we'll move past some of these things. I will stop to say that The Orphanage is a fantastic movie. We'll get back to that, though. We talked about Hellboy 2, which comes a couple years after Pan's Labyrinth, and then there's a long time...
Don't Be Afraid of the Dark is not. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. There's a long time spent in between things because he was working with Peter Jackson on making these Hobbit movies that didn't happen, obviously. And instead of, you know, getting maybe two films that were very possibly interesting and maybe better, we got three films.
Hellboy 3.
And no Hellboy 3. Yeah, lots of things just did not come together in the ways that he probably intended, despite being a man who, you know, assigns himself to various projects that gets all the fanboys very excited. He's like, oh, he's going to do this, and he's going to do that, and he's going to do that. Regardless, this brings us to Pacific Rim from a few years ago, pal. Where Guillermo del Toro got to show his love for kaiju battles and giant robots on the big screen and make another attempt at a big studio blockbuster. The movie has its kind of a mixed amount of love between people that thought it was dumb fun and people that thought it was just kind of dumb. Made money, not like overkilling it to guarantee a sequel, which is where we're kind of at now in terms of what he can work on next, because we don't really know if he's going to get to do Pacific Rim 2, which was supposed to start filming like next month, but now is on hiatus. With all that in mind, Jason, I know I can tell right now that you're not a huge fan of Pacific Rim, so I want to start with you.
No. I mean, you could easily just go, okay, well, listen, it's a mindless, you know, movie. He said it himself. It's just him playing around, a big kid, you know, with a big, you know, big set pieces and stuff. But that implies that you don't have to have any interesting performances, a good script or anything else. You just need to have the fun and the big spectacle effects. And that's all, you know, like you don't have to have any of the other stuff. But I can cite like 10 movies off the top of my head that have the same thing you're talking about, plus the script, plus the performances, plus everything else. Movie was kind of like it was fluffy. What I consider fluffy is I go in, I slightly enjoy it, I go home, I forget all about it. So the movie is big time fluff to me. So even as far as effects goes, it was okay. It wasn't great.
Others?
It is what it is, and some are gonna enjoy it for that, and some aren't. I think the movie, for me, I just the scale of it, watching the battles stuff was awesome. I think it overcame Charlie Hunnam, who I just don't get it with him.
Yeah, he's not. This is
boring to me.
But that's your leading man of the movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Your leading man. So it's
The other actors, you know, you do have some really
Idris Elba's fun.
Yeah, Clifton Collins Jr., I gotta say, is pretty good in that.
He is. Jimmy, you mentioned that because, like, we talk about the worlds he creates, and I do think he gets that here with just simple touches like Cliff Clifton Collins, I always say Clifton Curtis when I say Clifton Collins. Clifton Collins, like, the, his costume design alone is, like, tells a story.
Yeah, like, well, that's but that seems more like a Clifton's a great actor. That seems more like a Clifton thing. Like, when
you
I think
can
of
say
movie,
that, but it's not like Guillermo del Toro, like, is
no,
not.
No, I don't,
like,
I don't
right.
think
but
it
then
was.
But then
I
look at, like, Charlie
was,
Day,
actually.
And it's just like, you got the stereotypical wild, loud, crazy, wild. I mean, he's playing that part.
Again, though, he has all these tattoos all over his body. He's, like, he's this rock star persona that he's built for himself because of his love for these.
No, 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 I'm talking about Charlie Day. No, I said he Clifton to me felt like maybe that was more his doing as an actor. But when we're just going for, like, the one that I remember most was Charlie Day, because he was very fluffy, very light. He's what the audience likes. He's the comic relief. He's the kind of goofy guy. You know, it's that's what I see when I see these kind of movies. I'm not bagging on Clifton. I think Clifton's fabulous.
Yeah, I know he does.
What I'm saying is that I think both of them are part of a vision that Guillermo would have for who these characters are. And I could see Clifton Collins being a weird enough guy where he'd want to inject his own personality into what his character's design. But at the same time, these feel like if this is not a fantasy film for Guillermo del Toro, it's this, you know, it's a sci-fi adventure. And I could see him injecting that, you know, the same personality that brings us all these fantastical worlds, bringing us this sci-fi world where
look, del Toro is a very, very specific director. I think almost everything you see, pretty much everything you see on screen, it's something that he has an eye for, and he, whether it works or not, he always has that vision. And I swear to God, I don't remember. I've actually talked to Clifton about the tie, and because that's one thing that I thought that was hilarious, the little bow tie. I don't remember if that was Clifton's idea or if it was Del Toro. It might have been Del Toro's.
I'm not the world's biggest fan of them, but I'm not trying to bash the Transformers movies. But I felt like Pacific Rim's battles got right where those Transformers movies were not working for me.
How dare you?
And yeah, like, I felt like I got a real sense of scale, was able to like follow along with a lot of the action better.
See, that's a little bit my problem with the Transformers. I think it's the stuff around the battles in Transformers.
Well, yeah, that's what
exactly.
No, that's what really.
Obviously, that's more. Yeah, that's problematic for most people. But
I'm just saying that's maybe what me personally would have preferred them to, you know, appear like in scale and such. But you know, I think, you know, that's one thing that worked for me. But
the thing that gets to me about Pacific Rim, what holds it back from being, I guess, you know, higher up in my Del Toro-dom, is that the third act removes the scale. That's my biggest issue, where, like, the second act concludes with this, you know, epic battle in a city, concluding with this, just, you know, the thing takes flight and there's an awesome sword moment. Then it's like, let's go underwater and remove everything that communicates how big these things are, and then it becomes of any other action movie.
Because then what happens is you have to focus on the characters. And by that time, I've already checked out on most of those characters. Only person I liked was Ron Perlman. And even then, I was like, I want to see him red, and I want to see him with a cigar in his hand. So, I don't know, man. The characters, it's nice. The effects and stuff are nice. But if I don't care about the characters, it's not going
to
ring
true.
And
I agree. I don't think it's the strongest script compared to his other films, especially. It does feel like like a big come down.
But I agree with you in the passion sense, because but it confused me, because I do think in this particular movie, from everything that I saw him being interviewed and talking about, he really loved this movie, and which is odd to me, because, as I said, not in terms of the scale and like playing and doing all that stuff, but just in terms of like a script that's just not that great. You know, it interested me that he was so gung-ho about wanting to do a sequel to this particular movie. It's odd. But what's interesting is, a quick thing, is that in recent days, I have read a few interviews with him, and he sort of seems like he's saying, I'm going to go back to smaller stuff. And you know what? For me, for my money, that I think that's the best idea ever, because that's where his
go
passion...
Go back to Mexico.
No. That's where his passion meets the best material.
I can see where if anything, I think it's because he's getting pushed around so much in terms of what he can and can't do with, like, all the things happening with Pacific Rim, where, you know, it was Warner Brothers, and then Legendary took it and took it to Universal. You know, Universal doesn't know what they want to do anymore. And here's Guillermo del Toro, who's like, you know, in the midst of setting up an entire giant production for another Pacific Rim movie and suddenly has nothing to do, which is not the, and it's not the first time he's had to deal with this compared to, you know, with the Hobbits not, you know, completely falling through, with the, you know, his past history of other movies that he's attempted to be a part of, let alone whatever other stuff that he does in between these movies that he makes that, you know, we probably don't hear about, that he's like consultants on or tries to develop and goes nowhere. Like, in, you know, and like a video game that just fell apart on him. Like, there's, it's not hard to imagine why he would want to do something where he knows he can put his full passion in and probably have a majority of creative control over, when it's, you know, something smaller that comes from the heart, if you want to put it that way.
Right. And that's where, he shines, man. I mean, if you look on this list, you know, big, small, whatever, when he gets, when it's there and it feels right and it feels authentic and it feels, that's why I'm very interested to hear and see what, or hear your guys' take on it and see Crimson Peak, because I'm very curious to see what he did with that film.
I'm not, so we can move on to that real quick. Abe, I know you're there. I know you're happy.
Yeah, just no, listen, I'm actually apparently. Really happy listening.
I'm not going to talk too much about Crimson Peak, because Abe and I will talk about it on our next show. Jimmy, you can talk more about it. I'll
so
just
Abe,
say,
hold on, Abe, you didn't see the movie?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, okay,
but I will in preparation for this coming episode, or the next episode.
What I will say is that Crimson Peak is definitely a love letter to a lot of things that Guillermo del Toro loves very much. That's what I can say about that right now. Jimmy, what are your thoughts on Crimson Peak now?
What's weird is, you know, you kept hearing him talk in every interview, and I even asked him one time on the press line, maybe a couple. I was like, so talk about doing a ghost story. He kept saying, this is not really a ghost story. This is a gothic romance. So if you're thinking Wuthering Heights, if you're thinking these classic, like, there's something really old-fashioned about it.
Oh, it's very old-fashioned.
This is a romance.
This would be one of the best movies of the 70s.
Yes, this is a romance. This, and a lot of people, I'm hearing a lot of people say it's overly predictable. And it is a little predictable, but the thing about it is, it's very character-driven. It is, it's a romantic movie. And it's a, yes, there is a horror. And, you know, Aaron, there's a, gosh, I don't want to say too much, but there's a line referencing Ghost and what they mean in the film. Or in a book that's being written, and it's very true to the movie. You know which one I'm talking about, right?
Yes, I do.
And so I thought it was beautiful. I thought Tom Hiddleston and Jessica Chastain were great. I loved Mia Wasikowska. However you pronounce her name. Oh yeah, that's it. I think it's a really, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, Crimson Peak is a larger budget, bigger version of maybe his earlier work, and I really enjoyed it. And if you're going in looking for a straight out horror film or a haunted house movie, you're going to be disappointed. It's not that. It's not at all. It is a gothic romance on every level.
But what's interesting is, if you look at all of his films, none of them are easily categorized by saying, oh, it's this kind of movie. You know what I mean? Especially,
absolutely.
Especially the stuff that he is experimental on and stuff. And I love that. I don't need to have it be categorized. So I'm super fascinated.
This is one you're going to like a lot.
Nice.
Well, yeah, you look at like the Hellboy movies, and it's a mix of superhero and like Universal Monster movies. Like, that's what you look at Pacific Rim, and it's like a comic book movie mixed with this like alien invasion, but like there's a lot of things going on in this movie.
And this one has kind of elements of Hammer horror. This has elements of Disney's Haunted Mansion. I mean, it's a little bit of everything, and it also has a classic romantic story. You know, it really is. That's what it is.
So to back up a bit, because Guillermo del Toro has also attached his name to a number of different projects over the years. He's done just that. From that, we've gotten a variety of different films. The one I mainly want to point out is The Orphanage, because I do think that is the best film that he's been involved with that's, you know, not directly made by him. This is from J.A. Bayona, Juan Antonio Bayona, who's since gone on to direct The Impossible. And he just signed up for something else, too, I think. The World War Z sequel. He's attached to that for now, but The Orphanage, it's obvious it's not a Del Toro film, but it does feel like a movie that comes from someone that would be associated with him. You could watch the movie like The Orphanage and be like, huh, there's a lot of Del Toro in this.
Yeah,
and a lot of the others. Yes, but I personally love this movie. I think The Orphanage, again, much like how we mentioned Devil's Backbone's not a horror movie, just happens to have horror elements. This is very much the same. That said, it has creepy fucking kids in it. Like kids with potato sack masks over them with creepy eye patches. That's not fun. I don't want to be on the beach and be like, what's that in the distance? And then turn my back and then turn around again and it's closer to me and it's a kid with a potato sack over his head. That's not what I want to be involved with.
So. It sounds like Why not?
That's not fun for that's so much fun.
But it's a terrific. I recommend this movie to everybody who like just wants to see like a good ghost story, especially because I think the lead performance by what's her name, Belen Reedy, she is fantastic. And as this movie kind of reveals its various layers, there's such a great story that's unfolding before you, and it has the way it turns out is not when I initially saw it. It's not where I thought it was going. I just really love this movie.
And on the counterbalance, the Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. Jimmy, did we see Don't Be Afraid of the Dark together?
Yes, we did. We did.
Yeah.
One of Abe's favorite movies.
And I mean, you've got a good cast. You've got Guy Pearce, and you've got Katie
Pearce, who, and I've seen this movie once and barely remember it, but so the thing I remember clearly is that Guy Pearce worked in architecture. He made sure to point out all the time, I can't deal with my daughter who's fearing crazy monsters right now because there's an architecture convention going on.
That should have been a telltale.
Here's the thing about Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. The original film with Kim Darby, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was a TV movie.
It was
from the 70s, and it is terrifying.
It is.
That movie had me terrified. It was horrifying. It was these little creatures, and the ending. Oh my God! Do you remember that, Brandon? Do you remember that ending of that movie? It was horrifying. This movie, I literally, the one of these creatures gets squished, and the lights go on, and everyone's like, "Oh my gosh! Who knows? Nothing's going on." I'm like, just look over at the corner. Just look. The dumbest characters in this movie. It was painful. Oh my god.
My issues with both this and Mama, actually, and other films.
I didn't like Mama either, except for Justine. I liked her.
He shows his hand way too early. Both films show their hand way too early. You see these monsters, and you realize, like, with Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, it's like, just step on these. Get out of here. And with Mama, it's like, once you see Mama, it's like, oh, that's Mama. All right. There's no real suspense here about what Mama is anymore. It's right there. Crazy eyes looking at you. It's like, okay.
It's weird because I think he's had more success doing things outside the genre as a producer, because I thought Book of Life was really beautiful.
I really like Book of Life a lot.
It was great. Too. I thought Rise of the Guardians was a lot of fun. Beautiful with Javier Bardem. He's done some really great stuff. Splice is
a hidden gem.
Splice is my favorite non-Cronenberg movie.
Absolutely. So what I do like about the fact that the he puts his name to so many movies, and he really loves young filmmakers, and that's part of his passion, is finding these names and giving them a chance to do something cool and creative. Does it always work? No. But I think that's a testament to his love of film, and I do respect that. I just wish it was better than Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
He is a proponent of the animated films as well. Like, you see, he's a consultant, sometimes a producer. Book of Life's the one where he's like actually a producer, but yeah, he's a consultant on a lot of the DreamWorks movies. Like, he had a deal going there, where Kung Fu Panda 2 and Puss in Boots and Rise of the Guardians. Those are movies where, I'm not going to say you can directly feel his influence, but there's certainly, there's some aspects there where it's not just cookie cutter.
He's more than just the slap the name on the poster. You can actually see his involvement or touching it somewhere at some point down the line with a lot of his projects.
Movie like Rise of the Guardians, which I'm not as huge on as some people are, but I do appreciate that movie tries to go to some darker territory. It doesn't try to make it an easy movie about Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny having a good time and everything. Like, there's some interesting things there that don't shy away from the darkness that kids do like. I mean, we've talked about this in other podcasts before, but you look at movies from the 80s where there's a meaner streak in some of them than movies that you see now when it comes to kind of kids play and what have you.
Again, Book of Life, I think, is honestly one of the best animated features to come out in years. I think there's a really, as a dad, it's one of those rare movies where you can go, you know what? This talks about death in a very, I don't know. It's very deep, but it's also a way that you can kind of relate to kids in a very special way. And I think it's a really wonderful movie. And I think I loved his involvement with that. And that actually felt to me in many ways like it was a Del Toro film. It felt like he had a stamp on that one.
Well, as opposed to being like a creative consultant, he was a direct producer on the
movie. Yeah, exactly. Like, exactly. Yeah.
Also got a great cover of Mumford and Sons, I Will Wait.
Oh my God, so good.
I love the soundtrack and Creep as well.
Oh yeah,
Radiohead's Creep.
It's so clever and fun. And Jason, you like this one too, right?
I Book of Blood, yeah, right, yeah. Really good.
Last thing we should talk about before we wrap up here: The Strain. This is, of course, Guillermo del Toro. Apparently, wrote some books that I didn't know about until learning about this series. But he wrote a trilogy of horror novels with Chuck Hogan, and that's been turned into a series on FX. Did any of you guys watch The Strain?
No, I have not. No, I don't watch TV. So
I'm kind of with Jimmy on that. Not that I don't want to.
Jimmy, you've been recorded on this podcast saying how much you love American Horror Story.
I love American Horror Story, and I love Nashville. So,
Nashville.
So I watch those two shows. So there you go.
I haven't seen those companion series.
Yes.
Well, keep in mind, I'm the same way. There's so many movies, you know. It's hard to get to the TV stuff. So I mean, but The Strain would definitely be on there. American Horror Story would definitely be on there. Jimmy's told me a million times to watch that show.
So. Oh, you would like American.
There's so many movies, but there's also so much TV.
I know.
Yeah, honestly,
so wait. So who has seen The Strain?
I have watched all of The Strain. So I was just curious.
So how do you feel about it?
I think it's not great. That's what I've heard.
I think
it teeters on greatness so often, and then it just dials it back so much. It brings back the Reaper design from Blade 2 to make it like the constant threat, and where. Mm-hmm. I was hoping season two would be like, well, now we know what we're doing, so we can make this a much stronger series. And my problem with season two is that vampires, which have, in this show, they have crazy mouths that open up and shoot crazy tentacles at you that insert crazy worms inside you that make you a vampire, that should be fucking scary every time. And somehow, I'm not scared by any of the vampires in the show about The Strain. Like, so, wow. Like, by dissimulating the threat that, you know, should be terrifying to me, that does not help the show at all. First season, hit or miss, it was okay. Like, it had its moments going, and there's a cast here that I want to like more, because it stars Corey Stoll, friend of the show, Abe. Like, he's the lead character on The Strain, and somehow they decided to give him a wig, for one thing, which is terrible, which thankfully is gone at a point in the second season. But, like, his character is just so, like, blah. And that describes so many of these characters on this show, where it's like you get a couple of them that really work well. And I wish that with this show was better, because like all the ingredients are here to make for a really fun, like kind of campy, but also spooky vampire show that happens to be a weekly series on FX. So like, I'm curious, like how good these books are, apparently, since there's people that, you know, really love this show or based off the books or whatnot. But yeah, I'm not huge on The Strain. So yeah, that's why I got out of The Strain.
I watched the first like three episodes, and then it started piling on my DVR, and it just got to that point where it's like, you know what, I'm gonna delete these and just.
Wow, that's a shame.
It wasn't like awful, but it just, you know, it just wasn't something that was drawing me back to like must see.
So yeah, we've been talking about Guillermo del Toro for quite a bit now. Any other thoughts before we wrap up?
I want Mountains of I can't even talk.
The fabled Mountains of Madness.
Oh my God, I want that movie so
The
bad.
R-rated
no
Mountains
idea.
Of Madness.
This is like Terry Gilliam's Man of La Mancha. His Don Quixote. We constantly want this. We just don't think we'll ever never come to fruition.
Depending on when you ask him about it, it's like, yeah, we're looking. Oh yeah, no.
This is for people that don't know. This is a film that he would direct. Based off of H.P. Lovecraft work. James Cameron, I believe, was involved as a producer at some point.
There was like one big massive push for it like a few years back that, you know, Cameron got involved. I think Tom Cruise
was going to star.
Like they were pushing to get this done, and then ultimately Universal just said no.
Yeah, the biggest problem is that it would have to be R-rated.
Like, R-rated, yeah.
Because he does not want to compromise on that.
Budget plus the rating were just not working. If it would have been PG-13, they probably would have greenlit it for the budget they wanted, but they were insistent on R.
Because I want to see an R-rated Cthulhu, damn it.
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
You know, hopefully we get to see that movie one day. We don't have like a Jodorowsky's Dune with that movie.
Where we hear about all the amazing things that could have happened.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know it would be. And I don't want, you know, as interesting as that documentary possibly could be, I want to see that movie.
I would just say, you know, and by the way, in closing of Del Toro, you know, it seems like, you know, from looking at his work and from what you guys have, you know, information that I've read and you guys have said, that adversity is probably a really good thing for Guillermo, that he tends to do his most thoughtful, interesting, and amazing work when he's when adversity is sort of coming his way. So I sense a little bit of that now, and I'm very curious to see what he's. I mean, obviously, I want to watch Crimson Peak, but I'm very curious to see what he's going to do next. And so I may not seem like a fan, but I definitely am, and definitely always on the lookout for what he's going
to
do next.
He occupies this strange space where he seems to be able to go back and forth between, you know, these smaller projects, quote smaller projects, and things that he can kind of really put his back behind as far as making a mainstream film, but with his eyes on it. And it's I await to see what comes next for him based off just the fact that I think he needs to kind of go back to writing, to like refining what he does well when it comes to writing out his scripts and how to really focus things on what needs to happen versus how amazing he can make his films look, which is certainly, you know, that's not a bad thing whatsoever. I'd be very happy to see an okay Guillermo del Toro film if it looks amazing, just because I don't get to see this amount of craft very often in the way he brings it to screen. Any other thoughts?
I hope he doesn't get lap band surgery. I don't know if I can deal with skinny Toro.
He seems comfortably big. All right. Well, we've been talking about Guillermo del Toro, and we've been doing these horror bonus episodes. Next time, we're going to go a bit more modern with these and focus on the three W's of horror. We have James Wan, Adam Wingard, and Ty West. We're going to talk about their collection of films, which kind of reflects the modern era of horror that we're currently in to a degree. And that should be fun. I mean, we've been doing these kind of single filmmakers, and it'll be neat to kind of delve into more modern times, try to mix these up as far as these filmmaker spotlights go for these horror episodes. But with that said, let's go down the line here. Jimmy O, where can people find more of your work online?
You can find me on joeblow.com, arrowinthehead.com, Instagram, Facebook, you know, all those places. And I will let Jason tell you about our partnership, which is very exciting.
Jason. Yes, of course, you can catch any of my work at starpulse.com. And of course, Jimmy O and I do Flicks for Fans. So we try to do awesome events that are very reasonably priced for the average guy to get great stuff. So, of course, we're on Facebook, which is facebook.com/FlicksFor Fans.
Brandon Peters.
Check out my podcast, Cult Cinema Cavalcade, which is at cultcinemacavalcade.com. And like us on Facebook and all that fun stuff. I'm on Twitter at BT Peters.
Abe?
Find more fun stuff over at Aaron's work at Rand Hollywood. you can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/walrusmoose. Hashtag Guillermo del Toro tacos?
GDTTs.
GDTTs.
Tacos.
I'm writing daily about movies on randhollywood.com. You can find me on Twitter at Aaron's PS4. You can listen to all the other episodes about Now Out There and Abe on iTunes, Audio Boom. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/OutNowPodcast, Twitter, OutNow_podcast. Email us your thoughts on all the filmmakers we talked about so far at OutNowPodcast@gmail.com. I've had fun talking about Guillermo del Toro tonight, guys. Did you guys have fun?
Yeah,
absolutely. It went long, but there was a lot of insight that I got from you guys about the Toro, some stuff that I didn't know. So it never felt empty. It was really good.
It helps that, I mean, Guillermo del Toro is still an active filmmaker as opposed to Wes Craven and John Carpenter. Wes Craven, of course, you know, passed away, sadly. John Carpenter passed away from making good movies. So, yes. I mean, it's nice to talk about a filmmaker.
No, it's true. It's true.
It is true.
Who's very much been, you know, is continuing on and still has what I'd assume is years to come in terms of the movies that he can make and what he can continue to thrill us with or intrigue us by. I look forward to talking about next week with you guys about the filmmakers that are currently, putting their own stamp on the genre. And then, of course, at the end of October, we have something really cool coming as well. But for the time being, that's going to do it for this week's bonus episode about Now, Terry, and Abe, our filmmaker horror spotlights. So with all that said, until next week, that's going to do it. So long.
And goodbye.
In my flesh, in mind, in my mind. Two of a kind, but one won't survive. My image is reflecting the enemy's eye, and his image is reflecting mine at the same time. I against die. Flesh in my flesh, in mind, in my mind. Two of a kind, but one won't survive. Right here's where the end gon' start at. Conflict, contact, combat. Fight a sin where the land is marked at. Settle the dispute about who the live is. Three word answer, whoever survived this. Only one of us could ride forever, so you and I can't ride together, can't live or can't die together.